Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although Gloria Steinem is well known as a writer, lecturer, editor, feminist activist, she's not generally thought of as an avid traveler. In her first book in over 20 years, she offers a candid account of how her early years led her to an on-the-road kind of life, traveling, listening to people, learning, and creating change. The paperback edition of My Life on the Road has just been released by Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought Gloria Steinem to our show. Welcome.
And I'm pleased too. Thank you.
You estimate that you've spent at least half your life on the road?
Well, I started young because my parents spent half of their time in a house trailer. And I thought, of course, that I had rejected this form of living. You know, we think we're not going to be anything like our parents, and then it turns out we are. So it took me a while to come back to it, but because of being part of a social justice movement, it just seemed natural.
When you were young, did you assume that you would settle down at some point?
Yes, because I thought you had to. I thought it was obligatory. I mean, if I went to the movies, people were living in houses with picket fences, and for women especially, I thought you were supposed to get married and have children and settle down. So I just assumed that it was going to happen, but I kept putting it off. Just not right now.
Adventure and travel have been overwhelmingly a male prerogative. Don't women travelers traditionally come to a bad end? You mentioned Amelia Earhart and Thelma and Louise.
Yes, I do think that part of the reason I wanted to write a road book is that it is seen as a male genre, even though when they do DNA studies, they discover that women were the travelers more than men, partly because they were going to marry somewhere else or whatever. But anyway, they're probably more distant from the place they were born than men were. But it's perceived as a male genre. Think of Jack Kerouac.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have On the Road in your subtitle here, just as Jack Kerouac did, but this is a very different kind of book.
Yes, the one thing that we have in common, I realized after I started writing this book that I would have to explain why I was on the road all the time but didn't drive, because the form of movement travel means that you're on a bus or a train or a plane and you're going to a campus or a union or a meeting or something. People pick you up, you get to talk to them. And so I launched into a fierce defense of traveling this way, because if you don't drive, the moment you leave your door, you're in a different world. You're in a bus or a taxi with other people. But then I discovered that Kerouac didn't drive either.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt justified.
You say that you learned a lot about India because you didn't drive.
Yes. In India, of course, communal ways of travel are way more common. And that turned out to be very important. I mean, being in old English railway cars, there are women-only dormitory cars, rattletrap buses, you know.
Could you speak to people?
It's a communal experience.
You don't speak Hindi.
I don't speak Hindi, and Hindi is, of course, supposed to be the national language, but actually there are 14 major languages in India. It's a lot more like Europe. So English is also a national language. So you get to either speak English or kind of make do with English and a little Hindi.
Did you generally travel alone? You were married for a while, and there are no mentions of traveling companions in this memoir.
No, when I began to travel, I was always traveling with a speaking partner, because I was way too scared to speak by myself. You know, I had been two things in my life: a dancer and a writer. And I realized that both of those are, you don't have to talk. I have So I really, really did not want to speak in public and had never done it until I was in my middle 30s.
And you talk about having to get past that fear of speaking in public. How did you work it out?
Well, I never would have even tried if I had been able to publish what I wanted to publish about the first explosions of the women's movement, but the editors I'd been working for were not interested. And at the same time, I was getting a few speaking invitations because I was a writer. And it seemed the only way to talk about this excitement, but I was too afraid to do it by myself. So I asked Dorothy Pittman Hughes, who was a friend and who was married and had kids and was a child care expert, an African-American woman. I mean, you know, she was everything I was not. But, you know, I thought we would make a good team. And also, if I just, you know, failed to be able to keep on, she would go forward. And then after that, when she wanted to stay home with her new baby, Florence Kennedy, remember Florence Kennedy?
Yeah, the great African-American Florence Kennedy, civil rights attorney.
Right. She and I were speaking partners for a long time and several others. So in the beginning of being on the road, we were going out in pairs.
And with Florence Kennedy, you discussed the intersection of racism and sexism,
well,
which is still something that is a hot topic today.
Yes. I mean, we didn't so much discuss it as assume it. You know, I mean, then it was called double jeopardy. Now it's called intersectionality. But what was true then that I think we may not be aware of now is that African-American women were weighed disproportionately in the leadership of the women's movement or in the leadership of ideas, of understanding. I mean, for instance, once Ms. Magazine in an early issue did a Lewis Harris public opinion poll of nationally of women, American women, on women's issues. And it turned out that about 30% of white women were supportive of the movement and the issues of equality, and more than 60% of black women. So, you know, it was just present, and I regret that it's not always been recorded that way, because that renders those women less visible.
I'm speaking with Gloria Steinem, whose book My Life on the Road has just been reissued now in a paperback edition by Random House. You write about meeting a woman biker in South Dakota. Was it gratifying to learn that for her, the women's movement meant that she now rides her own Harley instead of riding behind her husband?
Yes, I thought it was great. I mean, first of all, it was a great lesson in not following your biases, all right, because I looked at all these bikers in this huge rally, thousands and thousands of people. And
most of them supporting Donald Trump, by the way.
Bikers? Do we know bikers have been surveyed as bikers?
Well, there have been a lot of bikers who have shown up whenever they talk about who's supporting Donald Trump.
I wonder.
Oh. Okay.
Because my preconceptions of bikers turned out to be wrong, or at least some, you know, quite wrong in this case. Because we, who were there for some Native, Alice Walker and I and Rebecca Adamson, were there for Native American events, and we were kind of avoiding the bikers. And then one day I was sitting in the motel dining room trying to be both cool and unjudgmental in the group of huge number of bikers. And one of the wives with a very improbable hairdo and leather and so on came over to me and said, you know, she said, I really enjoy Ms. Magazine, which just totally knocked me out.
And she knew who you were.
Yes. And not only that, but she said, isn't that woman you're traveling with Alice Walker? So, you know, it's just the road always teaches you not to preconceive. Anyway, so she then, before she left, told me to look out the window in the parking lot and see the purple Harley that was hers. And she explained to me that for a long time in her marriage, she had ridden on the back of her husband's motorcycle, but now finally she had her own. And she said, you know, you should see my grandkids' faces when Grandma drives up on her purple Harley. And she was very proud of it. And it just taught me such a lesson, you know, that we, anyway, I kind of end up saying we all have a purple Harley inside. We just have to get on it and ride.
You said earlier that you spent part of your childhood with your family living in a trailer. Was that during the full year? Didn't your father, Leo Steinem, run a dance pavilion in Michigan every summer?
Yes, he did. So we were there in the summertime. Mm-hmm. But he hated the cold weather. And he also had a small antique business. That is, he would buy antiques at auctions and sell them to roadside shops and so on. So he would do that in the fall. And then he would continue to do that as we drove and made our way in a house trailer to Florida or to California.
And he had to sell the antiques because you say he started out on a long trip with never having enough money to reach the destination?
No, he did. That's quite true. He was a dreamer and an optimist.
Was this always during the Depression, or
I was born. Yeah, I was born at the end of the Depression, so this was, during the war and after the war. Right.
If you were traveling, what about school?
That's a good question. My sister, who was 9 years older when we got to Florida or California, would go to school because she needed to do that in order to get into college, but I was young enough, so it didn't matter that much, and I was reading books all the time anyway.
You were homeschooled, in effect?
Yeah, I was book-schooled, right, mm-hmm. Right.
Did you ever wish that you had a more conventional life when you looked at other kids?
Yes, I think we all do, no. I imagined that one day I would live in a house with a pony and a... And that's partly why it took me a long time to realize, only after I had been on the road a lot in the era of the women's movement and other movements and traveling in that way, did I realize there might be a reason I felt at home doing that, that it had been my childhood.
Well, it's also kind of like a freelancer's right life.
Yes, yes. And my father was the ultimate freelancer, so he prepared me well for it. For insecurity, right.
You report that in 1957 you had an abortion in England. It was illegal in the United States at the time. What about in England?
It was a tiny bit less illegal in England, but it had to be life-threatening, and you had to have two physicians willing to sign, so it was still extremely difficult, but it was a little less impossible than it was here, which I didn't know at the time, but I happened to find in the phone book a very kind physician who was willing to take a pretty big risk and sign and be the first person who
signed. And say that it was life-threatening.
Yes. I mean, he was not, he was taking a risk. Right.
And you dedicated this book to him. Didn't he make you promise to do what you want to do with your life?
Mm-hmm. Yes. It was a lovely promise, a lovely
idea.
And
that stayed with you? That stuck with you?
It stayed with me, yes. And later on, I discovered that he had been the physician for the Sitwells, the family of writers.
Edith and...
And Osbert, yeah.
When did you decide to speak publicly about your abortion?
Well, in the first issue of Ms. Magazine, we followed the lead of French feminists who had published a long list of names of women, prominent and otherwise, who said, I have had an abortion, which was then illegal, and I demand the repeal of laws that are rendering this criminal and dangerous. That had been done in France, so we followed that in the first issue of Ms. Magazine. So I was asking other people to sign this petition, so clearly I had to sign it too.
Although there are a lot of women who've had abortions, many don't want to have not admitted to that. Why do you think that is?
Well, clearly it's it's like everything else that is supposed to be wrong but is actually common and human, whether it is same-sex love and marriage or... just all kinds of things that society says is wrong, even though it's entirely human,
Was that why you were reluctant to even talk about it until you felt that you had to sign?
Well, yes, because, first of all, I had promised the doctor I wouldn't, but also it kind of made you a bad person you know, we were just narrowly out of the era in which women were supposed to be virgins until they married, much less, you know, anything about abortion. Even though, statistically speaking, then as now, one in three American women has needed an abortion at some time in her life, that statistic has remained pretty much the same. The question is just whether it is life-endangering or legal and safe.
Who were some of the other women who signed?
Oh gosh, there were so many. We would have to look at the list.
But we don't have the time to do that because we're going to go take a little break. But we'll come back with more Gloria Steinem, her book "My Life on the Road," which includes a new chapter, by the way.
Yes. I'm glad that I was able to put a new chapter into the paperback that I had quite finished in time for the hardcover.
It's published by Random House. We will continue after this. We are back with Gloria Steinem, her book, the first book in a long time, My Life on the Road.
I've been writing, of course, articles and essays along the way, but this is the first book in quite a while.
Now, we mentioned India. You were there actually for 2 years. What were you doing there other than traveling around?
Well, I was kind of fascinated with India because my mother was a theosophist. So I had read, you know, children's books like Lotus Leaves for the Young and so on. And I took a course on India when I was in college, which was relatively rare to have at that time. But it just happened by accident that Chester Bowles, who was then the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to India, came to my college and gave a lecture and left the money, all of $1,000, as a fellowship to go to India. And also, it just happened that I was engaged in my senior year in college and realized that this would not be a good idea. It's a very nice man, but, you know, we were very different. But that I had to go very far away. So all those things, all those accidents of life meant that I went to India to spend a year and loved it and stayed for two.
And then after India, you moved to New York City.
Yes.
Began working as a freelance journalist. You don't include the story of how you were assigned by a magazine to apply for a job at Playboy, because that story's been told so many times.
Yes. This is an on-the-road book, and that was not an on-the-road job. It was just, you know, being a waitress here in the Playboy Club. So I didn't include it here.
Well, that article about the experience made you famous. Did the media often focus on your looks, which were perceived as being too pretty to be a feminist?
Yeah, they did. And even now, as old as I am, and I'm older than you, they still refer to me.
Is that possible?
I would like to comfort you by telling you that it's possible. People still refer to me, especially when they don't like me, as an ex-bunny. So it is a problem. I like to think it was worthwhile because I did change and improve the working conditions of the bunnies by the article, but it's been a bit of a bane as time goes on.
And now Playboy has changed totally, so we move on.
Well, it hasn't changed.
Gotten rid of the nudes.
Yes, but that's like saying that, how shall I say, that we won't have handguns anymore because there are assault rifles. I mean, you know, their philosophy has not changed.
You were traveling with Gay Talese and Saul Bellow once in a taxi, and you tell that story, what Gay said to Saul about you.
Well, I was freelancing, and I was trying to write an article about Robert Kennedy's campaign for the Senate from New York. And we just happened to be in a taxi together, and I was sitting between them. I had just interviewed Saul Bellow in Chicago for a profile, but it hadn't come out yet. And as I was talking about something else entirely, about how one could get Robert Kennedy, who was a completely authentic person, I have to say, he found it very difficult to answer a question when he knew you knew the answer. He would just say, "You know that."
So that would be lousy for a radio interview.
Right. So I was explaining to them what had been explained to me, that what you had to do was bring along somebody Bobby disagreed with, and then he would talk, and then you would get lots of quotes. So as I was in the middle of explaining what I thought was a helpful thing, Gay Talese kind of leaned across me and said to Saul Bellow, you know how every year there's a pretty girl who comes to New York and pretends to be a writer? Gloria is this year's pretty girl. My first impulse was that I was worried that Saul Bellow would be sorry that he'd given me an interview, since I was not a real writer. And only after I got out of the taxi did I realize I should have been mad on the spot and objected in the moment. And I was angry at myself for not doing it. You know, the interesting...
Have you spoken to Gay about that?
Well, what happened was, I put this in the book because I knew it was true. And though the book is fact-checked, I didn't call because I wasn't convinced that I just didn't know what would happen. But the New Yorker, when they did something about the book, included that quote. And they called him, and he said yes, he said that.
That's it. Well, he's had his own problems recently because of his most recent...
Well, problem. You know, to be fair to him, I think it's quite possible that in his mind, calling me a pretty girl was so wonderful that the rest didn't matter.
Yeah, but you were saying you were the flavor of the week.
Yeah, right, and that I wasn't a real writer. That was the most hurtful.
You were asked in 1968 to join the editorial board of New York Magazine, so somebody thought you were a writer. How'd you feel about being the only woman working with all of those accomplished men? Pete Hamill, Jimmy Breslin, Tom Wolfe.
Mm-hmm. And Clay Felker, who had been my editor at Esquire and a wonderful editor, a really innovative and wonderful...
The creator of New York Magazine.
Yeah, the creator of New York Magazine. You know, at that moment in time, I was kind of used to it, you know, being the only girl writer. There was also, do you remember a show called That Was the Week That Was?
Mm-hmm,
it
sure.
was the pioneer...
Very funny.
Satire show on television. I didn't do much for it, but I was also the only girl writer there. So it wasn't so unusual, and there was not yet a women's movement saying, wait a minute, you know, why is this true?
But hadn't Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex already been published?
Yes, it had been, and very important. But somehow it was distant enough and intellectual enough so that, and lacking enough in American examples, so that it wasn't as important in starting a movement as one might have wished.
My guest is Gloria Steinem. Her book, My Life on the Road, updated, has just been published in a paperback edition by Random House's WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The women's movement initially... You mentioned that a lot of African-American women associated themselves with feminism, but it was seen as a white middle-class movement.
They didn't associate themselves with feminism. They were feminists.
Okay, but it was perceived as a white middle-class movement.
Which was crazy. I mean, Fannie Lou Hamer was a great pioneer in coming forward and talking about reproductive rights, because she was talking about having been sterilized without her knowledge or permission when she went into a Mississippi hospital for something else. Johnny Tillman, who was part of the National Welfare Rights Organization, had done a funny, brilliant look at welfare policy as a gigantic husband that, you know, looked under your bed for shoes of other men and kept you on a short leash of money. And so I think, as far as I know, it was the first feminist analysis of social policy. Flo Kennedy, you know, was a pioneer feminist. So, you know, black women were always doing it in probably, according to public opinion polls, greater proportion than white women. But either because of just sheer racism in the media, or because of racism, white women's books were more likely to get published, I suppose. And also, I think, to be divisive, frankly, you know, to denigrate the women's movement. It was spoken of as a white middle-class movement.
Because when I think of the names that we generally heard in connection with that, Simone de Beauvoir, of course, mm-hmm. but also Bella Abzug and you,
mm-hmm.
And none of the names that you have just mentioned.
I know. Well, this has been a problem over time. And now with two friends who are African-American feminists of great standing, we're trying to do a book, a friendly book saying, you know, here are black women who invented feminism.
Were you inspired by Clay Felker's creation of New York Magazine to be one of the people who started Ms. in 1972?
Yes, no, absolutely. It taught me how to start a magazine. Not that there's only one way, but it taught me it was possible, let me put it that way, to start a new magazine. And it made me understand that even a terrific, lively, engaging magazine that New York was not going to be speaking about or for or from the women's movement.
And when you look back to the early years of that publication, do you find that a lot of the articles would be just as relevant today? I'm thinking of one that you wrote called If Men Could Menstruate.
Yes, right. Actually, that is newly booming, that article, because in a way you may have noticed in the past year or so, menstruation has come out of the closet. You know, that there, Newsweek had a whole cover that said there will be blood or something. Mm-hmm. And one of the marathon runners was running while menstruating. I mean, it's sort of come out in the open in a way. So now this may be the single thing I've ever written in my life that is the most read.
Well, it's good to have things reprinted. Wasn't there, you mentioned Bobby Kennedy, wasn't there some ill will among your friends who endorsed Bobby Kennedy that year when you were supporting Jean McCarthy? The two Kennedys had a lot in common.
Yeah, they did. And I think you and I both probably remember this kind of as a tough time because Robert Kennedy had been asked to run before Eugene McCarthy. Eugene McCarthy was not the first choice of the peace movement that was going around asking people, but he was the first person who said yes.
Well, there were a lot of people who, on the left, who were uncomfortable with Bobby Kennedy because he'd had that experience with Joe McCarthy, and they weren't sure that they could trust him.
Well, I think by then he'd kind of proven himself, I mean, as in terms of his change of heart and change of politics. I don't know. I'm sure different people had different feelings. But the fact that Eugene McCarthy had been there in New Hampshire, in the snows of New Hampshire, and that he was this silver-haired poet from Minnesota, you know, was very influential to me too, you know. So I had volunteered to help to write his campaign materials. And it was only when a group of us as writers went to interview him for those, you know, campaign subjects. And he said to us things like, well, okay, but don't talk about the war because New Hampshire is a hawk state. Mm-hmm. And we said, but wait a minute, you know, this is the heart of your campaign. I mean, he was so autocratic and... you know, he just wasn't what we expected at all. So I began to realize maybe we needed to think again.
But that kind of ill will has occurred again and again. Didn't something similar happen this year between supporters of Hillary and Bernie? And as you point out, between Clinton and Obama supporters in 2008?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. No, it can be very painful. You know, it's one thing to find oneself opposed to people who really, truly, sincerely disagree on the issues. It's something else to find oneself opposed to people you agree with. It's much more painful.
This year, you generated a bit of controversy when you appeared on the Bill Maher Show and said that young women supported Bernie Sanders so that they could meet young men.
But I did not say that.
What did you say?
Thank you for bringing that up because it drives me crazy. I had just, on the show, I had just been talking about young women being angry about graduating in huge debt, mm-hmm. and getting paid $1 million less over a lifetime to pay the debt back. So I was on the way to say, it was the first half of a sentence, I was on my way to saying that when you're young, you think that, you know, where the guys are, where the power is, not about dates, but about getting free universal education. So, but Bill interrupted me in the middle of the sentence. It was so far from what I was heading for that I didn't even get, you know, what he was saying. Oh, you know, how tough it would be if he said that. And I was sitting there saying, what, you know, how well do you know me? You know, that wasn't what I meant.
Well, it was a real show.
Education, though.
That show where people talk over each other all the time. You're never sure what people really intended
but
to
But it
say.
Was, in the end, it was extremely painful to be thought to be saying something I never would say. But it was a good education because it helped me understand what happens at Twitter length, you know, when something is out there that is deceptive, that seems to be saying something you didn't say.
Do you still frequently travel to college campuses for speaking engagements?
Yes, very.
And what kind of feedback are you getting from young people?
You know, I think there's a real resurgence of activism now, thanks to Black Lives Matter, which is crucial and was founded by three young African-American women, thanks to real discontent with the economic division in this country, which Bernie Sanders was very eloquent in talking about, and thanks to a new resurgence of very, very activist feminism on the web and in the streets. You know, and I hope and believe now there's much more understanding that sexism and racism, for instance, can really only be uprooted together because they're so intertwined. One can't really continue without the other.
You have a friendship with Wilma Mankiller, which always struck me as not necessarily the best name for a feminist. But
well, shall I explain her name?
She's the first elected chief of the Cherokee Nation.
Yes, for two terms. Should have been president of the country, an extraordinary woman. When asked about her name seriously, she would explain that it was a title, and it had once been White Man Killer. Mm-hmm. It was a title for someone who protected the village. When asked unseriously, she would say, "I earned it."
Just one other thing. Are there new issues? For example, the ERA never was passed.
Yes, no, we need, and a lot of the arguments against it are gone. You know, the arguments of that bathrooms would be integrated or that women would be in combat or that there would be same-sex marriage, you know, all of which happened anyway, with or without, you know.
Although they're still being debated today.
Yes, but, you know, it's and we still very much need it because the standard of scrutiny, of constitutional scrutiny for discrimination is still not as high for sex discrimination. So we still definitely need it. But I think what's happening now that's long overdue and exciting is that the issues that used to be viewed in silos, you know, that there were racial issues, women's issues, environmental issues, foreign policy issues, are now being seen as connected. So we're beginning to understand, for instance, that the single biggest indicator of whether a country in this world is violent inside itself or will be violent against another country militarily is not poverty or access to natural resources or religion or even degree of democracy. It's violence against females.
Gloria Steinem's My Life on the Road was a New York Times bestseller when it was released in hardcover, now available in paperback with a new chapter. It is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being here. Thank you for longevity.
I appreciate that. And you too. We both had a lot of longevity.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over 1,000 native plants exist in the metropolitan area, but they're being edged out by non-native species that have been imported into this country ever since the arrival of Europeans. Should that be a matter of concern? Well, we have invited Gerard Lordahl and Pete Murawski to our show here today to talk about, among other things, the matter of native versus non-native plants. Gerard Lordahl is the director of Open Space Greening Program at Grow NYC, and Pete Murawski is the founder of Native Landscapes in Pawling, New York. Welcome to our show.
Good to be here.
And we will be taking calls from listeners about their plants, helping them transition to fall or any of the other things that they have to deal with. You can reach us at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate. You can send us a tweet. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You can also find us on Facebook. So how can you tell if something is indigenous or is non-native? Obviously, if something is called the London Plane Tree or Norway Maple, that's a big clue. But in many cases, we wouldn't know. Pete?
No, Leonard, it's all about education. And going out in the woods and studying Mother Nature and going into the most natural area you can find where it hasn't been very disturbed. And then you can find plants that have been there for sometimes centuries. And they've created these ecosystems that just kind of depend on one another for survival.
And Pete's right, if I might just add that if you look back at the history of Manhattan in particular, you'll read about pink lady slippers and different types of native plants that used to be here hundreds of years ago and are now extinct.
And why have they gone extinct? Could we pull them out and put in other things?
I'm sure Pete could.
Or we probably paved over part of it.
Invasives are part of that problem. I think we would agree that because of all the people who have come in and the habitats that have been lost and invasive plants and European type plants that have been added, that has taken over the natives.
We've changed our landscape so much that they've been pushed out and they're now out in the woods. For instance, let's take Long Island, for instance. Long Island is an end moraine. It's an island that was developed from the last ice age. And if you look on the North Shore, it's a very rocky, hilly terrain. And if you look on the South Shore, it's an outwash plain. And in some of these outwash plains, you're going to find, you know, the pine barren forests, which have been here for hundreds and thousands of years. And that's where a lot of these native plants have gone. They've gone out into the wilderness, and they're doing their own thing in their own little ecosystem.
But weren't many of the trees that were brought here brought because they resist insects? Is that a bad thing?
No, they were brought here because they came from they were brought over here from Europe and Asia, and this is the same climate that they had over there, so they can survive here. But they have no ecological significance. In other words, none of the wild bugs or animals can eat these plants. There's this whole symbiotic relationship that begins with native plants, and it all starts with bringing natives back into the landscape.
Why do we want to encourage bugs to eat the plants?
Well, I think it's more about, going with plants that can survive low maintenance, that would tolerate pests and diseases. And I think your listeners will be surprised by all of the native plants that are really around. It's no mystery. These native plants are common plants that Pete and I work with on a daily basis. Beach plum, northern bayberry, winterberry, Virginia creeper vine in your backyard, monarda, milkweed. It's not a real mystery. A lot of people are scared off by the word native plants because they're not sure what they are. The Brooklyn Botanic Garden has a great list. You could find out what they are. But, they're resistant to some of these pests.
But the insects are eaten by the birds, and we want to encourage that.
That's right. This whole native system that exists in the natural world, we need to sustain that because it's a part of our natural heritage. We need to sustain that because it creates a cleaner, healthier outdoor environment for us and them.
I read in the New York Times that if you cut down the goldenrod, the wild black cherry, the milkweed, and other natives, you eliminate the larvae and starve the birds.
That's exactly right.
That's right. And invasives can alter the plant's biology. Where these natives are being overtaken by the invasive plants, and these invasive plants can cause changes in our native plants, is what I'm saying. And that could cause such changes that the wildlife can no longer depend on these plants for sustenance.
They're disrupting the native ecosystem. For instance, the Dutch elm disease was devastated by a bug and a fungus that came here because we were bringing plants from all over the planet. Okay, the chestnut, which was 70% of our woods, is now gone because of plants that we brought in from other continents.
Hasn't kudzu pretty much destroyed much of the forest in the south?
Kudzu, the Japanese honeysuckle, the Norway maple, the Russian olive, but it goes much deeper than that, Leonard. Let's look at the barberry, for instance. The barberry harbors ticks. Okay, what they do is they create this little mimicking environment, and the ticks harbor in them because the bugs can't get in them, and now the
because they have thorns.
Because they have thorns, and the tick population is exploding, and that's why everybody's getting this Lyme disease and ehrlichiosis. You know, they're creating an imbalance in our natural world.
So we're worried about the deer, but the deer are just getting the ticks from brushing up against the barberry.
That's right. Mm.
What about popular plants like white clover, Queen Anne's lace, or dandelions? Weren't they brought in?
They were brought in, but they're not invasive. Many of those plants aren't. You know, they're setting up a niche in the natural world where they can survive. In other words, like you see a lot of Queen Anne's lace growing along the road or along highways in very nasty soils. White clover also is a nitrogen fixer. It takes nitrogen out of the air and brings it into the soil. So some of these plants are not bad things. There's invasive, and there's plants that have been added to our ecosystem that are okay, but the invasives are the ones we got to be
invasive is another word for weeds or vines?
Plants that are just taking over our natural environment.
And some of your listeners would know, people who live on lakesides, purple loosestrife is a big problem along waterfronts. That's on the New York State list of invasive plants that are restricted, or things like oriental bittersweet. There are lists that people can access.
That's right.
I read that a reason that monarch butterfly populations have decreased by an estimated 81% between 1999 and 2010, I'm sure it's even worse now, is because there has been a 58% decline in milkweed presence over the same period.
That's right. Asclepias tuberosa, for the botanical name, is this orange flowering native. You get the flower in July and August, and at Grow NYC, we actually provide it to our community gardeners to encourage them to grow this butterfly weed, because monarch caterpillars find it to be their favorite food. So that's something your listeners can do in their own backyard.
And bees also like milkweed. But don't butterflies love buddleia, the so-called butterfly bush, which isn't a native plant?
But they're not getting the nutritional value from these buddleias. In other words, they need something that's going to sustain them in the natural world. And I'll give you a for instance that goes beyond butterflies. Take the migrating birds, okay? Cornus rasmosa, which is the great twig dogwood, exists in most meadows from Georgia to Maine. Okay, this little seed or fruit, which is the size of a pea, grows on this plant, and the migrating birds take it and they eat it, and it sustains them because of the very high protein in this seed. Now, because of this, there's one study that shows that many of our migrating birds wouldn't make it across the Chesapeake Bay if this seed didn't exist in the natural world.
My guests are Pete Murawski of Native Landscapes of Pawling, New York, and Gerard Lordell, Director of the Open Space Greening Program at Grow NYC. We are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate, or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is @LeonardLopate. And let's go to a couple of those calls. Tricia from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, you guys. I was calling to speak out for the American pokeberry and leaving it in your garden. And most letters from the Civil War were written in fermented pokeberry juice, and it just has amazing antiviral properties, but it's also like a high protein source, like the great twig dogwood.
Are they in danger of disappearing?
People pull them as weeds.
Mm-hmm. See, this is part of our natural heritage. We really need to educate the public and show them what was here 300 to 500 years ago, and let's bring them back to the garden because they're so important to the natural world.
Gerard, isn't there some program a rooftop program that has been devised to bring back some wildflowers on top of the Broadway stages in Greenpoint. Do you know about that?
I do know about it, and I think rooftops are playing more and more of a vital role, and that particular one is doing what many other community rooftops are doing, where they're planting things. We were in Long Island City on a rooftop yesterday in Hunters Point South, and we get a huge number of insects and birds that come and feed on our wildflowers, the seeds, et cetera. So we're making a concerted effort to plant things like asclepias and these natives that, as Peter said, will give them more nutrition to survive.
And Leonard, this is a quality of life issue. I mean, sitting in your yard and watching these hummingbirds and butterflies go by, checking out all these native plants, you know, there's no need to put all these big bird feeders out anymore. You plant it, and all these wonderful native insects will come.
What about our obsession with grass? I read that the United States has 40 million acres of lawn and pavement that winds up covering 5.5 times the size of New Jersey.
What an unnatural land management practice, Leonard. A lot of chemicals go into lawns. You know, we try to create these monoculture lawns, but I think we need to take a step back, because in order to stay sustainable, we need to get rid of this whole thinking that we need to have these monoculture lawns and we need to almost create lawn drug addicts. You know, we got to get away from these four-step programs. You know, what's wrong with looking out at your lawn in the springtime and seeing beautiful violets growing on the lawn? And what's wrong with turning, we don't need to be mowing 5 and 10 acres of lawn. What's wrong with turning 6 or 8 acres into meadow and watching these beautiful wildflower meadows circle our lawn? Once again, this to me is a quality of life issue.
And the issue for New York City, as is the other suburbs in our area, is that people tend to put a lot of pest control material on their lawns. And in New York City, we have this combined sewer overflow issue where the rainwater and the sewage is combined, and in heavy rains, all of those chemicals go into our water system that we're swimming in, and this is the pollution problem.
To create a more natural approach, get away from all these chemicals, and mimic Mother Nature and her, how she rules and works.
So you don't want to use pesticides at all?
Well, only if there's an infestation, okay? Sometimes, and then go with low-grade pesticides, you know, oils, soaps. Stay away from the skull and crossbone type pesticides, because they're not good for the natural environment.
Mark from the Lower East Side. Hi, you're on the air. Mark, are you there?
Yes, hi. Yeah, hi.
Go ahead.
So my interest on this conversation, which is a very interesting one, was on the apple trees. From what I understand, apples originated in Kazakhstan, quite possibly, and the only way that you can manipulate the species is through grafting, if you just arbitrarily throw apple seeds around like Johnny Appleseed. The apple tree will grow into any one of any number of trees. What caused the extinction of the apple species that were around, say, in the lifetime of George Washington?
Well, this supports the exotics. I mean, not all natives are bad, and without our exotics, we wouldn't have apples, we wouldn't have lilies, we wouldn't have rice growing in New York City, peonies, Queen Anne's lace, things like that. But as you say, you know, these are plants that we've come to love, and they're not from this area. Every plant species is native to somewhere, and the apples are from Kazakhstan, and they are grafted, and you know, there's got to be a balance, I think, of natives and exotics. And as far as propagating these things, it's part of evolution. And man has come to a point where we are selective about what we love, and we're protecting those plants that we get the most enjoyment from.
But I love apples. But there's a tree called the pawpaw plant. And I've had the fruit of the pawpaw. It's rare now. I understand that when Europeans came here, it was all over the place. Mm-hmm. Why, if that fruit is so delicious, has it pretty much disappeared?
Well, it's a tough tree tough shrub to propagate. And I'm finding that a lot of these nurseries now are taking the time to propagate these shrubs. You're starting to see it more and more. But I could tell you 10 or 15 years ago, it wasn't there. And the problem was when people were digging them out of the wild, and they were just not surviving. Once again, it's like the mountain laurel. It's like any of these tough propagating species. But it's coming around, and I'm starting to see it more and more in the nursery trade.
We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back with more of your calls. You can also write to us. Our phone number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. My guests are Gerard Lordahl, director of the Open Space Screening Program at Grow NYC, and Pete Morosky of Native Landscapes in Pawling, New York. We're back with Gerard Lordahl, director of the Open Space Greening Program at Grow NYC, and Pete Morosky of Native Landscapes in Pawling, New York. The only business that's on the Appalachian Trail?
Well, we're the only business, right. We're the only garden center on the Appalachian Trail. The Appalachian Trail comes through Native Landscapes, and we're very happy that we're part of the Appalachian Trail community. In fact, Pawling and Dover got together and created the Harlem Valley Appalachian Trail community. Some of the wonderful things we do up there are we have the Warrior Hikers. They come through in July, and we have a barbecue for them. We set them up overnight. We do their laundry. And, you know, what a great thing that these veterans do. And a lot of them are hiking the trail. They started in Georgia. They get to us in about 2 or 3 months. They're walking off the trail. And we just love the fact that that they come through every year, and we make a big deal out of it.
You have a business called Native Landscapes. Do you find that people are becoming more interested in native plants?
They want to create a cleaner outdoor environment around their house. And bringing in native plants requires less pesticides, less fertilizer. It's a common sense approach to gardening and landscaping. And yes, I'm finding a big push in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. Jan from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I have a peach tree with delicious peaches, but about two-thirds of them have worms. And my question is, when I eat them, I just, you know, cut the worm out. And I'm wondering if I can, you know, I throw the peels in the pit in the compost. Can I throw the worm in there, too, or am I going to give myself worse problems next year?
Well, you know, it's recommended in compost piles that you don't put any diseased leaves and things, and it's not really recommended because then you just perpetuate the disease. And as far as biological control, which is your best solution for this, make sure at the end of the season you clean up under the tree and remove any mummies, they call them, which are the dead peaches that are on the fruit. That will help prevent the disease from coming back. But we discourage using chemical pest control. So try biological control by cleaning up.
There are good worms and bad worms,
right,
aren't there? I mean, you want some kinds of worms in your compost if you are doing composting.
Yeah, you want earthworms that are going to break up the compost a little bit. But going back to this peach story, last winter was an interesting weather phenomenon. And many of the peaches up in the Hudson Valleys passed on because we had a very mild winter through November, December, January, and February. And we got to the point where a lot of these peaches and a lot of these flowering plants were about to come out, and then boom, we got 17 below zero. So many of the peach trees up by us did not produce any fruit because of this fickle weather and climate we're having right now that's playing a major role in what's going on in the natural world.
And we knew that in our green markets, Leonard, because the peach farmers were letting us know that was a damaging frost in February and March. And you'll notice many of our peaches in the markets are from South Carolina and not from New York State.
Or even New Jersey.
Or New Jersey.
Now, I want to get back to Jan's question. What happens if you wind up eating a little bit of that worm? Is that dangerous?
Extra protein. You haven't eaten worms, Leonard?
I actually have. Because I've had mescal.
That's fine. You know, like you said, extra protein, and the bigger the worm, the better.
But do the worms do anything bad to the peach, or is just what is Jan's solution, just cutting them out the best way to deal with it?
Cutting them out is the best way. It blisters the peach a little bit, but 90% of the peach still stays fresh and good.
Okay, Jan?
Hey, thank you.
And we go now to Dan, Morristown, New Jersey. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi, great. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, you know, I'm really into, like, family history, and I recently spent about 3 hours in a graveyard trying to find a gravestone in Pennsylvania. And basically, after 3 hours, what I found out was that there was a whole section of the graveyard that was covered with almost like a bamboo-type species of plant. I think I've identified it as, like, a Japanese knotweed. And but the thing is, it's covering up more than a dozen graves, and I found my, you know, long lost cousin in the center of this Japanese knotweed. And so basically, I'm trying to figure out how I can help to, you know, get rid of this problem that's basically an invasive species overtaking the graveyard.
And Pete, I should point out that this is not the only call about Japanese knotweed. Mm. So this has become a big problem in this area.
Invasive species are really taking over a lot of areas. You go up into the Sawmill Parkway and the vines are just choking every tree species. And that's because carbon dioxide has become a major player. And vines love carbon dioxide. Basically, you got to get in there with your machete or your weed eater and you got to really whack it down a few times. And once you do that, the plant will say, heck with this, I'm out of here because I can't survive under these conditions. But it takes some mechanical working to get some of these vines away, and it's beyond the tipping point in some situations where, yes, try to keep it away from your properties and, like you said, in the cemetery areas, but there's no way we're going to be able to control it on a worldwide basis.
But you said whack them with machetes, but they still have roots, so don't they just grow back?
Well, they can't conduct photosynthesis once you whack them back to the ground, and it weakens them.
Right.
And over time, they'll definitely go away, but they won't unless something is done mechanically.
And Leonard, the New York City community gardeners can relate to this guy's pain, because in New York City, many times there's Japanese knotweed in these gardens, and you really have to get your pickaxe and your shovels and dig down like 3 feet to remove all that root and then smother it with plywood as much as you can to kill, as you say, the roots, because they're very hardy in a sense.
And how do they even get there?
A lot of times birds are just dropping the seeds. Pete will agree that our invasives are spread by the seed dispersal, but from birds, and people bring them in as well. I mean, when you drive around, you see a lot of Oriental bittersweet, which is a beautiful vine, but it's also very invasive. It's in our parks, and your listeners can go to the park's website and download all these invasive species that are smothering more beautiful plants that are native.
A listener on our show page writes, I used poison in my yard for the first time ever to eradicate poison ivy. Did I have another choice? Understanding that they use goats in Prospect Park, but I'm not going to bring a goat into my backyard.
Poison ivy is a tough one. You got to get to the root of the problem, and you got to get some gloves on, and you got to literally yank it out. I've got a few guys that work for me that are not allergic to the poison ivy, so we send them out on a regular basis. But growing in the woods, poison ivy is a beautiful vine. It's got a beautiful fall color. I mean, that along with the Virginia creeper is a nice native vine in the woods. Just don't touch it.
And porcelain berry. And for your listeners, Leonard, wrap your hands in double garbage bags with gloves. And in the wintertime, when the poison ivy is least potent, try to yank it out, as Peter said, with someone who's not sensitive to the allergen.
And be careful burning it, because if you burn poison ivy, you can get it in your lungs. That's a real problem.
Stephen from Airmont, New York. Is it Airmont? Or
yes,
Armont?
It is.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, my question is, and you've been addressing it in bits and pieces here, which of these species are invasive and native are being really helped or hurt by the by global warming?
That's a great question.
Specifically, in other words, which invasives are being hurt by global warming, which ones are being helped, and vice versa?
Well, not only is it global warming, but it's also we're getting less rain than we've had in the last couple of years. 70% of the country right now is under some type of drought watch or warning, and if it's not raining, it's flooding. So a lot of these plants that like more drier conditions, plants like yucca, plants like St. John's wort, plants that like it a little bit drier than wet, seem to be thriving, where a lot of the wet and marginally hardy plants that don't like it so wet are really kind of fading away.
And in New York City, we do rain gardens, which exactly what Pete says. These are plants that are tolerant of extreme drought and flooding. And there's a list on at grownyc.org. If you connect to our rain garden brochure, you could download the list of rain garden plants from the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, things that'll survive in extreme drought and flooding.
So right. You should send those that list to San Bernardino area.
Right. They're going to need it.
Rain gardens, bioretention areas, these are the waves of the future. And not only do they bring native plants back into the landscape, but they also clean the storm water as they enter a lot of these big water bodies.
Rick on Twitter asked what to do about invasives like phragmites, which are not native to the Northeast but provide important habitat for marsh birds.
Phragmites is a tough one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough one. It's all over the place. I mean, way back when I had my chemical pesticide applicator license, we used to have people go through with a brush and some and just dab the open wounds, but that it's really too far gone, and it's a shame. It's hard to say what might. I mean, there's a study now going on Long Island to try to do something about the phragmites, and let's hope they work something out.
Eric from Brooklyn, you're on the air. Eric, are you there? Okay, well. How about Paul from Manhattan?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I was wondering if either of you gentlemen can recommend a small tree or a larger shrub like an arborvitae that could be planted in a yard over a septic system so it doesn't have deep roots to interfere with the septic.
Are you talking evergreen or deciduous?
It could be either. I mean, I just want something to landscape my front yard with, but that's where the septic system
fields are. Well, my suggestion for some native trees, and Pete could add to this, we love serviceberry or amelanchier, and it's great for the wildlife. And I myself live in Brooklyn, and I have a beautiful eastern red cedar in my backyard that I love. It's evergreen. So along with gray birch, I'll pass it to Pete.
Yeah, if you wanted to do something that gives you a little bit of fruit, too, try the beech plum. Beech plum is a nice plant that, you know, draws a lot of nutrients out of the ground. There's also the pawpaw tree that we mentioned before. Depending on what your pH is, you could try blueberries because blueberries like a little bit of an acidic soil, and they would all benefit from a lot of nutrient value inside, you know, in the soil.
But they all have shallow root systems, right?
Relatively. Winterberry is another one, relatively shallow rooted. It's related to the holly or the ilex, and you get berries on the female. So there's like six suggestions for you.
Is it bad to plant things over septics?
It's not bad, but stay away from stuff that has deep roots like oaks and anything that's going to get real willows.
But the soil isn't affected by the fact that the septic is there.
No.
Eric, we're going to give you another chance. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I wanted to call in because I actually have a green infrastructure company in New York City, and we've been doing a lot of rain gardens and green use and such, and we've noticed that a lot of building owners are really receptive to native plants, especially mm-hmm. when it's on the rooftops, because you know, a lot of families can't really go out and enjoy nature, and so bringing nature back into the city is kind of something that everyone really appreciates. It's kind of just a natural good feeling. And also, the DEP, Department of Environmental Protection, has a green infrastructure grant program that actually allows, they'll fund the design and construction for these green infrastructure projects, and they really do encourage native planting. So I just wanted to get my 2 cents in there and let
That's
you...
That's great. Thanks for sharing that information. So the state DEC and DEP as well.
Michael from Westport, Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard.
Go ahead, Michael.
Thank you. So I am, can you hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. So I've got a screening of trees of evergreens, and I'm wondering, they're getting very thin, and I'm wondering if I top them out, if they would kind of grow back fuller.
What kind of trees are they?
Well, they're kind of, I'm not sure. I think they're either blue spruce or Norwegian pine, Norwegian wood, perhaps.
Well, whenever you top a tree, it'll force it to grow laterally. What you want to do is they've probably gotten a little too tight, so take out a lot of the dead. And also, you know, put in a nice bed of organic mulch underneath it and give them a natural fertilizing, so to speak. And that should spark them back into life.
Thanks for your call. Rochelle from the Jersey Shore asks, can you support a small yard grass replacement option? I live at the shore and have a tiny yard space, 40 by 40. I want to be able to walk around on it, hence grass, but also I have several evergreens, which affect the ground's pH, combined with the sandy soil. So it's a big water and fertilizer consumer. What's the right thing to do?
Yeah, definitely go with your seaside plantings. There are lots of native drought-tolerant plants, the swamp rose, for instance, opuntia, which is prickly pear, which is really hardy in sandy soil, full sun, doesn't require a lot of maintenance, and it's native. Pete mentioned before beech plum, a maritime peach. These are plants that would do well along the seashore and don't require a lot of water. Mulching is also important as well when possible, but that's what I would go with.
Now, a lot of the invasive species are in our public parks. Has there been a program to replace them?
Well, I hope so.
With natives?
There is a big program, and if you go to the website of the Parks Department, they have a concerted effort with staff and lots of maintenance people going around the park removing invasives. There's a list of the invasives. They have the goats in Prospect Park doing the weeding. So they want to preserve as much of the native forest as possible.
There's also a lot of volunteer programs that you get involved with. And, you know, put your gloves on and help out, because I think that is going to go a long ways in getting rid of a lot of this stuff.
I heard that one of the best trees for the area is the native oak tree, but I don't have any acorns around. And how long does it take to actually grow a tree when you're starting from scratch?
Well, oak trees are cyclical. In other words, one year there'll be so many acorns on the ground, you'll slip and fall on them, and the next year there won't be. You want to plant a tree that's fairly good in size to get the acorns sooner than later. The white oak is probably one of the better oaks to plant because more wildlife likes the white oak, and then also the red oak, because these are trees that are adapted to our soils and climates and require less time and effort to get going.
Are there any things that we can plant that'll keep the deer away? And because they have become invasive.
Absolutely.
In so many areas.
Absolutely. Deer, researchers have found that deer do not like anything that smells lemony. Mm. And there are certain native plants that give off a lemony-type smell that keeps things like deers away.
Can you spray lemon juice on
tomato
plants?
Yes, a lot of times they use that kind of spray to keep certain wildlife away.
You can make your own kind of deer get out of here type tea, with peppers, with and deer hate the smell of eggs, so if you mix some egg in there and mix it with a little bit of oil, it'll stay on there for a couple rains too.
It's called spicebush. I just remembered the name. It's an early flowering yellow plant, and it has a spicy lemon aroma, and it's a natural deer repellent. Huh. Sometimes they use it as a substitute for allspice, so people could check that out. But if your listeners want to do anything, you mentioned seeds. Sow local native seeds, and that could help this cause.
Bayberry is another great plant that is fairly deer resistant, and their berries are so helpful to the migrating birds.
And we have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. But my thanks to both of you so much. Pete Murawski of Native Landscapes in Pawling, New York, on Route 22, and Gerard Lordahl, director of the Open Space Greening Program here in New York at Grow NYC. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This election season is a stark reminder of the major role race plays not only in politics, but in many areas of our society, including criminal justice, housing, and jobs. Often overlooked is how it affects medicine and doctor-patient relations. In his book, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race in Medicine, Dr. Damon Tweedy writes about how his race was a factor in medical school and continues to be a factor in diagnosis, socioeconomic background, and bills of health. His book is published by Picador, and I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Damon Tweedy to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's my pleasure to be here.
Before the Affordable Health Care Act, studies showed that black people were less likely to go to the doctor even when they had medical coverage. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I think there are a lot of factors at work. I mean, so when you say someone has medical coverage, I mean, there's so many different degrees of what that entails. So there's, you know, there's private insurance, there's public, you know, and then there's public insurance with Medicaid and Medicare, and there's certain barriers to receiving care. If you have, you know, even if you have insurance, it doesn't mean that you still have access to the same types of doctors and quality of care. So that's one component to it. And then there's another component, which is in terms of the issues of stigma and the issues of concerns about the healthcare system itself and sort of being resistant and afraid in some ways of the healthcare system. So that's another sort of layer to a larger puzzle.
And why would there be a fear of the healthcare system?
Yeah, so you know, it's interesting. So where my book sort of starts off is with this quote from Martin Luther King Jr. from 1966, where he talks about, the quote goes, "If all the forms of inequality, injustice, and health is the most shocking and the most inhumane." And so at that time, he was speaking to a group of physicians who were trying to advocate for change in the healthcare system. And in that world, I mean, there was this really, this is sort of an era still of segregation just sort of crumbling down. And there's a lot of stories, oral history, and there's just sort of stories of problems that African-Americans would encounter in the healthcare system, mistreatment, bias, just really not getting care at all. And so these are all things that sort of have a cultural memory in ways and often still, even in modern times, discourage people from seeking care.
Well, we've come a long way from the Tuskegee studies, but was there...
Well, yeah, so...
Go ahead.
No, so that was certainly going on during that time, right? So the Tuskegee study, it ended in 1972, which in some ways seems like a long period of time, but when you think about it, that's really just slightly more than a generation. So a lot of the lingering memories of that study and many others still linger today.
Are black patients more likely to seek out a black doctor?
It depends. So for some patients, for some groups of African-American patients, that's a really important issue, particularly in around certain disciplines. If you think about something like mental health, which is my field, psychiatry, but also in primary care, these are fields where the doctor and the patient relationship is in some ways even more paramount than it might be for a doctor who's sort of treating a dermatologist or an orthopedic surgeon who's sort of treating maybe a more discrete problem. So when you're talking about a relationship that lasts over time, yes. I mean, there's studies that I talk about in the book that point to that.
Because the reason I ask is I know I've spoken to a number of women about whether they prefer a male or female OBGYN sure. or a gynecologist, and it almost splits down the middle.
Yes. So as a medical student, I've certainly been on, when I was rotating through my OBGYN rotation, I was certainly on the end of that, of many women particularly wanting a female gynecologist. But I think the thing about that is you have to be careful and not automatically just make assumptions, though, because like nowadays, if I see a female patient in the clinic, and I might make an assumption that she automatically wants to see a female psychiatrist or psychologist, and that's not always the case. So I think, you know, when you're talking about do black patients want to see a black doctor, I don't think we should just make a blanket assumption. But at the same time, there are many people for whom that is an important issue. And one of the realities of our healthcare system today is that, and particularly in many cities, you have large African-American populations, but very small numbers of African-American doctors. So, for instance, about 4% of the practicing doctors nationwide are African-American. And in many cities, for instance, Baltimore, it's 2/3 of the population is African-American. Here in North Carolina, in Durham, about 40% of the population is African-American. So you have this large sort of discrepancy between the population of patients and then the population of available physicians. So it can be an issue for many patients.
And is the reason that African-Americans are less likely to try to go to medical school?
There are a lot of factors at work here. So when you're talking about why are there fewer numbers of African-Americans in the healthcare field, it actually even has a gender split to it. So there was a report that came out about a year ago, published by, it's called the Association of American Medical Colleges. And they looked at this in some depth. And they found that African-American men in particular have not really, actually compared to 1978, the numbers are stagnant, which is really striking when you think about the numbers of all other demographic groups among physicians have increased considerably. So now African-American women outnumber African-American men in medical school 2-1. And I think there are a lot of, so the question is obviously is why. And I think there are a lot of barriers in place, a lot of factors in terms of what people see for themselves. The media, in many ways, crafts a narrative. I'm not trying to blame the media per se, but there's a narrative that's often crafted among about what African-American men can achieve and what their success looks like. And I think in some ways, that's a huge factor. So because part of the problem is that there aren't enough people who are getting through the pipeline, who are qualified to, you know, to go to college and then from college to medical school. So there's a huge gap there at the very early stages of life. So we're talking about needing reform in the education system and just a lot of other factors at work to really address that larger problem.
Had you always wanted to be a doctor?
No. So from personal experience, I grew up in suburban Washington, D.C., in Maryland, about 10 minutes outside the city, and it was in a community that was 100% African American. It was a working class community. My dad worked as a meat cutter for a grocery store chain, and my mom worked for the federal government in an administrative, you know, sort of position. And there were no, you know, medical people in my family or community. So it was not something I would have conceived of myself. So, for instance, as a 12 or 13-year-old, the idea that I would, you know, be a doctor here 30 years later talking to you would have been inconceivable for me at that stage in my life. There weren't role models in medicine. The first time I actually saw an African-American physician, I was probably about 17. I mean, I actually saw someone in the flesh, and that was an older guy. And then the first time I saw someone who was sort of younger and I felt like I could relate to even more, I was in college. And that was really the first time that I began to think about medicine as a career for myself. So I think for a lot of people, it's just not even seeing people like yourself who are in those positions that really limits your own sense of who you can be.
Damon Tweedy is my guest. He's written a book that's was a New York Times bestseller when it was in hardcover, now available in paperback. From Picador, called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I was wondering whether a black doctor might be more aware of some of the more common health problems that African Americans face and be more aware of some of the studies that have been done. It's been pointed out that many of the studies have excluded African Americans, but they're still have been a fair number in recent years.
So what I would say is in medical school, they teach you about the health disparities, the differences in health outcomes based on race. So when you're in medical school, for instance, for me, 20 years ago, they would say, well, hypertension, high blood pressure, it's more common among African Americans.
Which you learned personally, didn't you? You were diagnosed with high blood pressure when you were very young.
Exactly. So they tell you this information, but what's not necessarily goes along with it is maybe understanding the context as to why and what are some of the barriers that maybe are more subtle as to why the person is having these problems, but then also maybe not having the outcome that a doctor would expect. So that's where having the experience of living in a community can be very advantageous. So I wouldn't say so much about the diagnosis, but about how do you manage it and where do you go from there. So for me, you know, as you mentioned, I was diagnosed with high blood pressure myself as a first-year medical student. I was 23 years old. I'd played basketball in college. I was, you know, thin and felt like I was in tip-top shape. And so it was a really striking, kind of devastating experience because it wasn't just high blood pressure. They also found that I had some early signs of kidney disease based on the tests that they ran. So it was really, at that time, seemed to be a really serious problem. And so for me as a medical student and then later as a doctor, I had a lot of knowledge about, you know, what to do about it. How do you change your diet? How do you do these different things to make things better? But I still struggled tremendously. And part of that struggle was a psychological struggle as to what it meant to sort of eat a certain way, to exercise a certain way. I had these sort of barriers in my mind that these were things that were for a certain segment of the population, you know, mainly well-to-do white people, whereas I come from a very lower working class African-American background. And so for me, it was like, well, if I'm going to eat, like today for lunch, I had a salad and, you know, a little bit of chicken on there and an apple. Now, for me, 20, you know, 30 years ago, that would have seemed like, why in the world would I eat food like that? You know, baked chicken, a salad. It would have felt like I was in some ways giving up a part of my identity, the way that I had grown up within my African-American community, the foods that I ate and how that was all tied together. And so understanding that as a doctor and your patient is something I don't think all doctors would necessarily understand or know what to do with that.
Well, how
so
much
for me, I've seen...
Oh, go ahead. Finish.
No, go ahead. So what I would say to that is I've certainly seen patients myself over the years, and we've explored those kind of questions. And so because in a medical setting, a doctor might give a person a medication, and if they come back and the blood pressure is still high, they may give them another one, but not really understanding like what's getting in the way of this person sort of getting the changes that need to be made. And so that's where my own personal background in that kind of community can really be helpful.
How much of that is the result of diet and exercise and related matters? How much of it is genetic?
Yeah, so there's several theories. If you're talking about high blood pressure in particular, but really for other medical conditions.
Well, diabetes
as well,
is another case that we see. It's quite common in the African American community.
So basically, any and those two diseases in particular lead to heart disease, stroke, kidney disease. So you have this whole range of disorders that sort of all are connected. And in medical school, the sort of the mantra I adopted was that being black was somehow bad for your health. So again, there's a question as to why. So it was almost framed like it was strictly a, almost like a genetic or a biological aspect to it. And I think that that's, my experience is that that's a, I would say that's a really small part to it. I think a much larger part is the socioeconomic aspect, the issues around diet, the issues around, you know, the community you live in, the stresses that you face. I think those are much, much larger factors in this problem. My own personal story is an example. So for me, with high blood pressure, after I sort of got over that psychological challenge, I was able to, you know, adopt a healthy diet, no special name to the diet and nothing sort of magical, but just following a sensible diet, and my blood pressure has been completely normal for more than 10 years without medication. And so to me, that pre and post was strictly a factor of sort of diet and exercise and managing stress. And so I think that speaks true for a larger segment of African Americans as well. I think the idea that you can say it's genetic, I'm not saying we shouldn't look into those things, but to think that genetics is simply destiny, I think, is really short-sighted because it overlooks the ways in which people themselves can really impact health, their own health.
You attended Duke University School of Medicine. Do you think you would have had a different education if you'd gone to a northern college?
That's a great question. And some, you know, because Duke is in North Carolina, and as I write in the book, Duke certainly has a history of racial problems. There's no doubt about that, particularly in the 60s and 70s, and even later on, it's had issues. But what I would say to that is that since the book's been out in the past year, I've had a chance to travel to various medical schools and interact with doctors, you know, black doctors from all across the country, and they have the same stories. And so in some ways, there may be a few things that would have been a little different. Like, for instance, at Duke, there were some, in the South, there are some people that are really tied to the old South and Confederacy, and those things you might not see in New York. But as far as the more subtle things that happen that are much more common, the microaggressions, as they're called, those things happen everywhere.
And could you talk about those? You describe how you had to deal with race when you were in medical school.
Sure. Yeah. So the book actually opens up after I sort of, so the goal of the book is to really talk about the health disparities, and I'm using patient stories of people to really illustrate all the factors that go into that, the socioeconomic, the doctor-patient relationship and those things. But then another big part of the story is my own journey of being an African-American man, going through medical training, and then what it's like for black doctors in a larger sense. So in the first chapter of the book, I describe a scene with me as a first-year medical student. And I'm leaving a lecture hall. There's a break between lectures, and then I go out to use the restroom and come back in the lecture hall. And a professor of the course, this is about 3 weeks into the semester, he comes up to me and confronts me at the entrance to the lecture hall. And he immediately says, are you here to fix the lights in the classroom? And I'm looking around thinking, is there someone else behind me, next to me? Realize it's just me and him. And he says, well, I called about this last week. Why haven't you done this? So he was really sort of amplified the exchange. And, I wanted to look for another explanation as to why he might think that I was in this role. And I said, well, no, I'm not here. And then his response was, I'm not here for this purpose. And he said, well, then why are you here in my class? And so for me, looking around, I wanted to find another explanation, but I was dressed the same way. I had the same books. And I could only come to this conclusion that, he saw me differently because I stood out in this obvious way.
And were you the only black student in the class?
I wasn't the only black student in the class, although that's an experience I did have quite a bit. But at this point in time, Duke was actually in their very first year of increasing the numbers of African-American students in medical school. So that for many years, Duke had very few African-American students in their medical school classes. And this was basically the first year. They had new leadership, and they were really trying to make a concerted effort to change that. And so it was sort of the contrast between the old ways and sort of what was becoming the new way of things. And this professor was an older person. He had sort of been in that system from the older way. So I think there may have been resistance in some way, whether conscious or otherwise, to the changes that were occurring.
You touched
this exchange we had was an expression of that.
you touch on something called Best Black Syndrome. What's that?
Yeah, well, so that's the idea. Similar to that is this idea of when students, schools are trying to attract African-American students to medical schools and things like that. It's almost like a search to find the sort of the best black person, you know. So because it, as we said in the earlier on, there are a small number of sort of what they would call qualified African-American students because of so many other issues in our society. When you get to the point of a medical school application, there's a really small number of folks who are there available. And so schools go through great lengths to try and attract those students. And so that's sort of the context under which I found myself when I was applying to medical school.
My guest is Damon Tweedy. He's assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center and a staff physician at the Durham Veteran Affairs Medical Center. He has written a book that is now available in paperback, bestseller when it was in hardcover. It's called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. It's published by Picador. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Dr. Damon Tweedy. His book, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine, now available in paperback from Picador. How did your African-American peers react when you told them about some of the experiences we've been talking about?
They were not surprised. Many of them felt like, and it's the quote from them, that I was actually telling their own story in so many ways. So what I found was that my book was in some ways a vehicle for them to kind of express their own challenges and triumphs over discrimination. And some of the stories they told were just incredible. I mean, things that were even more, far more egregious than things that I put in my own book.
But do you think your experiences and their experiences when told to others discourage African-Americans from entering medical school or hoping to move on to something in other areas of higher learning?
Well, two things. So one, I would say, is that those challenges are present in other fields as well. So I've had many people in the legal profession, the business world, share very similar stories. And some stories are in some ways even more challenging because there's even more subjectivity in some of those other fields. So I would say I don't think it would uniquely discourage them from going into medicine. And in many of the stories that I tell in the book are really stories of triumph and sort of overcoming these challenges. And so that's sort of how it's been framed. So I haven't gotten that impression that I'm sort of discouraging folks, because it's really just telling the truth in some ways. And so what's also been really interesting is how many of my former classmates, you know, who are primarily white and Asian, have come back to me and responded with surprise, because we were in the same school, same time, going through the same rotations and same hospital, but in some ways our experiences were so different, even though on the surface it seemed to be very similar. So I've had a lot of feedback along those lines as well. So I think it's, in some ways, it's been a way to open other people's eyes who might not be aware of some of these realities.
You write that you fainted from the sight of blood when you were in medical school.
Oh, no, that was actually college. So I'd gotten past that by the time I got to medical school. Yes, I was a little bit squeamish when I was working in a research lab when they were studying animals. And so the whole idea of doing surgery on rats was a little bit unsettling to me. And that was actually my very, very first day of a research lab. So that was like the worst first impression that one could make, would be to pass out 5 minutes into your first internship experience.
Yeah, it would
so they rushed me to a hospital. So they rushed me to a hospital, and so I got a chance to interact with some really young doctors. So I tried to make the most of that and turn a bad into a good, because I started to shadow some of those doctors who treated me initially.
But it would make you think twice about wanting to become a doctor. What made you change your goal? You originally wanted to be a cardiologist, and then instead you switched to psychiatry.
Yeah, so the cardiology piece came from two things. That first research experience that I just described was actually working with a cardiologist, and he was a young African-American cardiologist. He had trained at Johns Hopkins, and that was the first time I really had a chance to really interact with a young African-American doctor. So there was that piece to it. Then also my own experience with high blood pressure and some family members who had had heart disease. My grandmother had died from heart failure early in my first year of medical school. So all those things made me think about cardiology as a career, because there's an enormous disparity in terms of health when you look at cardiovascular health among African-Americans. But so psychiatry I kind of fell into. I had a couple friends, close friends, who were also African-American, who suffered some pretty significant mental health problems, challenges when they were in graduate school and in medical school. And it really opened my eyes, because these are people who are really successful, and then they suddenly had this event happen to them, seemingly out of their control, and it really impacted and in some ways derailed what they were trying to accomplish. So that was really striking to me. At the same time, I also saw that there were a lot of people in the African-American community who had a lot of there's a lot of stigma around mental illness. I mean, there is in general, but even more so among the African-American community. There's a lot of fear of seeking medical care in that realm. And I felt like there was a great need. I mean, there's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of issues and so I felt like there was a role that I could play. But to be honest, when I first did my psychiatry rotation, again, not making the best first impression, when I interviewed a patient at the end of the rotation, the doctor suggested that I might want to become a pathologist who didn't actually treat living patients. So not to dismiss pathology as a great career, but his point was that I had really poor bedside manner. So it was a work in progress. But I've fallen into psychiatry over the years, and it's worked out very well for me.
Along these lines, a listener has tweeted us, can Dr. Tweedy address the crisis of access to quality, culturally literate mental health care? And are there any organizations that are addressing this?
Yeah, there actually is an association of black psychiatrists as well as psychologists who they have a website, and they list some different providers and practitioners in various areas. But to be honest with you, there's a tremendous shortage of mental health providers, particularly if you're looking for someone within the as far as black psychologists and psychiatrists. There's definitely a shortage, but there are some web sources. If you look at those, Google those particular associations, and you'll find some information there for different geographic regions. But that's a huge problem, and that's something that I've written about and talked about in other forums as well.
You've called one of your chapters Baby Mamas. Why did you pick mm-hmm. that name?
I guess in some ways it's a term that's used. I don't particularly like that term. And it's often been associated with, African-American women in sort of our cultural lexicon. I really don't like the term itself, but I think it was the best way to illustrate some of the challenges that I was trying to present in that chapter, where I talk about this idea of single moms, young black women having children in really difficult socioeconomic situations, and really people coming with different sorts of biases and misperceptions, and just sort of trying to understand where people are coming from. It really was an eye-opening experience for me, because it was, despite my own background, which was not particularly well-to-do, I saw other challenges that I wasn't even aware of, and I saw the ways in which women, in many cases, were getting really inadequate care. And so I really wanted to illustrate in that sort of way.
Is there a perception among doctors and nurses that teen pregnancies are still a major problem in the black community? Haven't the rates gone down?
Oh, they've gone down a lot. If you compare it like to 20 years ago, the numbers have probably halved. But so the perceptions, though, are still strong. I mean, and so one of the things that I highlight in the book are just the different examples of how African-American person can come into a medical setting, and the perception of that person can often be unfavorable. And so I talk about it often with many patients that I saw. Once where a guy came into a clinic, and he had he had high blood pressure, he had some chest pain, everything turned out to be okay medically, but because he was sort of questioning some of the doctor's recommendations, but in a very thoughtful way, in a very correct way actually, they labeled him with a mental health problem. And it was just like, wow, why would they do that? But there was this this sort of perception of what this person could be and what they could do. And the story that really encapsulates that for me is, I was a patient once where I had a knee injury, and I came into a urgent care clinic, and I had come from home working in the yard, and I was dressed casually, sweatpants, not in my doctor attire. And, the nurse was very nice, but then the doctor comes in, doesn't look at me, the whole electronic medical record thing. But beyond that, he never really engages with me at all, and just tells me, you'll be fine, you can leave, without examining my knee or anything. And then, me being a doctor, knowing that was not the standard of care that was appropriate, I mentioned some vague medical terms, and suddenly he got more interested, and finally realized that I was a doctor, and the entire thing changed. He's like, well, now I have to examine your knee. Mm-hmm. I want to get an x-ray. I want to do this. And so it was really being two different people. It was an illustration of how you could just be two different people in one clinical, you know, so, you know, you could be two different people at one time, and how so many patients could come into a doctor and be treated differently based on their appearance and what the doctor might think or perceive of what that person is capable of or how smart they are.
So give inadequate medical treatment because of that?
Sure. Sure, and I don't think it's not even necessarily intentional. It's just about perceptions that people can have of, and so because these things are deep rooted in our society, particularly among, you know, particularly towards young African American men. There's perceptions of threat and violence and, you know, being angry and not being smart and all these sorts of things, and these things creep out. And there's no reason to think that they wouldn't impact everyone in society, and they certainly impact doctors as well. And I don't think it's often a deliberate attempt to provide less adequate care, but in practice, that's what often plays out.
You write about watching a patient at the Grady Memorial Hospital where you worked in Atlanta, a woman named Lucy, go through a code. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Yes. Yeah, so it's another issue of how the social impacts the medical. And so that's the, one of the great lessons of medical school. It's not just about, you know, science and knowing all the proper medical care. It's about understanding the context of people and their lives. And in her case, she had a son who had been in the legal system and was involved in until he was on probation or something like that. And he was involved in an incident at a nightclub and was arrested after that. And then that basically just sent her over the top because she knew he was going back to prison. And, you know, she was not in great health to begin with, but this sort of incident just tipped her over, and she had a heart attack and a code. And so I was right there to witness all that in the emergency room. And it was just so striking to see how here we are. We know all this medical stuff. We have all this knowledge. But how do we relate to this experience that this woman had? And then not just her, but then we had to tell her family what had taken place. And so it's a deeply sort of powerful experience of trying to deal with life and death and how society impacts health.
You did an emergency run with two paramedics at Grady Hospital. What happened during that day, and what did you learn during that run?
Yeah, it was even more along those same lines, because when you're in a hospital or a clinic, people are coming to you. They're on your turf. You're seeing them within the narrow confines of what's there, but you're not really seeing what is it that's happening on the outside that's bringing people into the clinic. Why are they having the problems that they're having? Why are they not getting better? Why do you see people continue to come in with issues of trauma and violence? And so these are things that you don't necessarily see when you're only seeing them on your turf in the hospital. So at first I really was reluctant to do that. I don't want to, you know, do this rotation, riding out an ambulance with two paramedics or EMS workers, but it was really eye-opening. I mean, we went all through the city, and you just see all the problems, the poverty, and how it impacts health. And so at the very end of that day, we went out to a housing project. And so I'm from the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area. I've certainly seen housing projects, driven through them, had family members who lived in not-so-great areas. But this seemed so different. It was so isolated, and it was out in the woods. And you might think it's a gated community, but until you get up close, and you see how horrible it was. And it was like a prison or a psychiatric facility is what it looked like. And then when I was there, you know, we were going to pick up a woman who had had some kind of confrontation, and then I saw these two boys outside playing, and they were playing football, but they were throwing it in the midst of glass and rodents and all cigarette butts and all other sorts of things, and it just made me reflect on how people's opportunities in life, how different they can be, and how, you know, certainly just the unfairness of the system, unfairness of life, but how, you know, we rush to make judgments about people without really understanding the context and the challenges that they actually face. And so it made me realize that here I was at this point, almost a doctor, almost graduated medical school, and was going to have this, you know, really successful future in this way. But it was in some ways hollow if I wasn't doing something that could look at these larger issues and try to address them in some way. And so that was really the sort of the lesson of that experience.
You write about Dr. Ben Carson throughout the book. For many Americans, he's probably the only black doctor they've ever seen. And I'm not sure that he always presented himself in the best way. Have you ever met him?
Yes, no, yes, I have. And so I talk about that in the book. So I met him in the way that I talk about Dr. Carson in the book, so this book was largely written before 2013, before he sort of transformed into a sort of political figure. He was really a tremendous medical hero, particularly among African-American medical students. And what I would find is that every time you'd meet African-American medical students, they always you always have a large number of them who would want to become neurosurgeons because Ben Carson was a neurosurgeon and was so famous among black medical students and doctors. And so it is actually statistical data to show that there are higher numbers of African American neurosurgeons, you know, proportionally than as compared to other ethnic groups. I think a large part is that it was his tremendous influence. And so the book is sort of conceived of in the way I write about Ben Carson is from that lens. I actually had a chance to meet him when I was in college getting ready to choose medical schools between Johns Hopkins and Duke, and he hosted this thing at Johns Hopkins where you get a chance to meet other African American doctors there at the hospital. So I have to say it was a surprise when he it wasn't so much the politics, it was just sort of the way he was sort of presenting what he was saying was so striking because it was very different than the experience that I had had with him and many other doctors had had with him over the years. So it was very striking. And so
I have to end it here. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I want, again, to remind people that my guest is Dr. Damon Tweedy, assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center, staff physician at the Durham Veteran Affairs Medical Center. His book, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine, is published by Picador. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.